Hey everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got an announcement of global proportions here on the Device Talks weekly podcast. Chris Neumacher, editor-in-chief of Mass Device, will join us just after the music to reveal the news. I don't want to steal his thunder or spoil anything, so I'll just stop talking about it, but look forward to bringing you that great bit of news. After that, I had the extraordinary pleasure of talking with Arun Menawat. He is the chairman and CEO of Profound Medical. He is quite an accomplished CEO and entrepreneur, and he's been a real pioneer in the imaging space. I have not given much attention to imaging, or at least too much thought. I'm sure I've written about it over my career, but I've always been more of a device kind of thing you can hold in your hand kind of guy. Arun Menawat really opened my eyes to sort of the evolution of imaging in healthcare. Obviously, the importance of it. I think we're all aware of that. But Profound Medical has sort of stage three type of approach of how MR can be used as part of a therapy, or at least in conjunction to a therapy that Profound Medical has developed. So great story by Arun Menawat. Profound Medical is a really intriguing company. Profound did sponsor this episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast, as you can see on our podcast graphic. But they came to us wanting to share this story, and really happy that they did, because I don't know, it just seems like one of those med tech stories that as you're hearing it, it not only makes a lot of sense, but it makes you feel pretty good about what's coming down the pike. So I won't steal Profound or Arun Menawat's thunder anymore, but grateful to have Arun and Profound on the podcast. But before we begin this episode, I wanted to remind you that our Device Talks Tuesdays episodes continue to roll out. Join us on Tuesday, 4 p.m., to hear our next webinar brought to you by Tekin. It's called Navigating Complex Design Landscapes, a deep dive into complex medtech system design with emphasis, which is a part of Tekin. So join us this coming Tuesday, June 11th. We'll have other episodes following the following weeks. You can find them all at devicetalks.com. So make sure you don't miss that. Registration, by the way, for Device Talks West will be opening up in a couple of weeks. I've got a bit of a Device Talks West announcement in this podcast. You can listen a little bit later. So lots happening here at Device Talks. Yes, summer is rolling around, but things don't really seem to slow down very much. And that's okay, because we love what we do. All right, folks, let's not delay any further. Let us get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Neumacher, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. I'm sitting here on a beautiful Friday morning here in Minneapolis, drinking out of my Boston mug. Look at this.
Look at that. Did you get that at the, I won't mention the brand of coffee shop that's in every airport in the world at Boston, at Logan?
Let's just say my son, who just finished second grade, is really fond of blueberry scones. So I stopped at that establishment on the way home and got him a blueberry scone. But you see, I got this, why not? Let's say it. It's Starbucks. I got a Starbucks. I got a Starbucks.
It's cautious last time because it exploded in your mic. Oh, I shouldn't have expected an explosion.
I did not get the exploding mug from the Starbucks. Starbucks, I see microwave dishwasher safe on the bottom.
Oh, you did it. Okay.
You got to look out for that stuff. You can't buy a coffee mug that isn't microwave or dishwasher safe.
Oh, I've got my lovely Edwards Life Sciences mug that I got out there when I was filming with them. I don't think I'm putting this in the microwave. It doesn't say. I would tip it upside down and read it, but it's got coffee in it. So
Don't spill coffee on yourself in front of me.
Oh, no. I only do that kind of slapstick for video humor. I'm not going to do that for a podcast.
Don't make yourself in need of like some of the products we talk about this morning. Good Lord.
Lordy, 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 lordy.
Tom just spilled hot coffee on himself right in front of me. You'd be awake, though. You'd be awake for that Friday morning.
I would do anything for a laugh. Waka, waka. Look at me.
There we go.
So we are bringing back a familiar feature to the podcast, Chris. You want to tell our listeners?
Well, by
since
popular
it is named after you, yes.
By popular demand, we are bringing back the New Markers Newsmakers.
Woo-hoo! Yes.
We've got a drum
trademark
roll.
Pending.
That's right.
We're not going to do that anymore. I remember I was listening to some older episodes, and we had I tried to put in a lot of sound effects and things like that.
Yeah.
And it was fun for a time, but I think we're going a little more serious here. We're two very serious journalists, Chris. You know,
it's true. Very, very. Yes, Tom.
We have to slip into our NPR voice.
Get my NPR voice. Yeah,
next on Device Talks Morning Edition.
What kind of weather? Now the weather.
So we're going to do the news markers.
We had
which
some
is
fun.
Exciting.
People need some fun during the pandemic, but here we are. Yes, we are in the post-pandemic period. We will more seriously talk about this important industry that we cover that, improves and saves lives. So there we are. Yes.
So I think this will be a fluid design for the newsmakers. I think we could certainly bring in a newsmaker for a conversation from time to time and have that be a newsmaker segment. But I think more directly or more often we'll just recount the news of the week. Some of the maybe three or four highlights. We may not do a big old countdown, but we'll keep our faithful listeners abreast to the news they need to know about, which I think is a noble effort.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
of course, these articles we will be pulled hot off the presses of Mass Device and Medical Design and Outsourcing, even though Mass Device doesn't require presses. It's a digital publication, but Chris will use his editorial judgment to assess what the largest articles and a lot of it, I think, will definitely come from viewing clicks. Do we still say clicks? I guess we're still saying clicks.
Why
sounds
not?
Sounds so .com.
Sounds very 2000s.
Anyway,
sounds
it
very...
does, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, sounds very, but anyway.
So articles that are well read. Well, yes. Your readership of Mass Device will help guide this discussion.
I mean, to describe the processes, I mean, I'm going on to my Google Analytics and saying, like, what are the articles that, our audience, who are, insiders and leaders in the industry have, read the most this week. And, I'm throwing on a little extra editorial judgment along the way because, for example, like as much as people are interested that, Medtronic took out a few extra billion dollars in lending or whatnot. Like how much interesting things could we say about that?
That's a great point.
So we,
our listeners can put the big old burger on the counter and you are adding the accoutrement, the ketchup, the lettuce, the onions. You're giving it the flavor.
A little secret sauce. Yeah, exactly.
Which is just usually Thousand Island dressing.
It's mannese mixed with ketchup. But don't worry about it. Just it's delicious. The pickles are good. Yes, it's good.
All right. So let's dive into this MedTech burger, Chris. What's our number? What's our first story we're going to talk about?
Well, first up on the menu, we've got...
You just listened to your NPR voice right there. He did.
Tom, you're making me. Yes. Tom. So the first thing on the menu is we've got Microbot Medical getting a approval from the FDA to start a human clinical trial of its Liberty Endovascular Robotic Surgery System. And I mean, Tom, the space is just so dynamic right now. There's so many companies coming out with all these different type of technologies and surgical robotics right now. I mean, we only really start covering this company a lot this year.
It's an interesting space for sure. It's why we're focusing so much attention on it at our Device Talks meetings, and surgical robotics will be a big part of Device Talks West. And I'll be down at SRS annual meeting in Orlando in a couple of weeks because how can you not be? There's
totally.
Just so much to talk about.
It's good. It's good. We got a presence there with you. And early this year, I put out like a 10 story on Mass Device, 10 surgical robotic companies you need to know. There's so many other companies we're covering. I had a list of like 14 other companies at the bottom of that story. Like, hey, you should also know about this company. And we had just only started to learn about Microbot at that point. And they're not in the article you know, I mean, I think when I get that updated soon, I mean, I'll have to be listing them at the bottom as well, because they're hitting some big big milestones. But I mean, it just shows how much is going on in that space. And I recall, you know, when we were talking about surgical robotics with Joe Mollings from the Mollings Group. I mean, it's really interesting right now that you got Intuitive rolling out the Da Vinci 5, kind of what he called like that deepening of the moat for them, and you know, those like high acuity hospital settings. But you know, he was saying like the real competition, real exciting stuff was going to be all that stuff around that, like all these other, you know, needs where Intuitive hasn't really done a lot yet. And you know, I mean, this company is a great example of that.
Yeah, and we were going to dig deep into Microbot a bit. I mean, they're based in Braintree, Massachusetts, which I wanted to point out. So they're a Massachusetts company.
Offices in Israel,
Offices in Israel. They're in the endovascular, neurovascular space. So they've got competition with Telos, which is Imperative Care's robotic surgical division. And Siemens, the Health and Ear is their robot they gave up on cardiology. But I think they're still
talking about neuro. They're still doing some stuff in neuro with it.
But if we could continue to talk about Microbot, which is a very important company, but this week also we had news that Moon Surgical received another FDA approval, expanding its reach in the largest healthcare market in the world. And I think I think the Maestro is the kind of device that, you know, I think could probably fill in a lot of the blanks that an Intuitive has in terms of market penetration, because it's a smaller robot and is less disruptive too.
And it's kind of a robotic. It's like a robotic surgical assistant, you know. So I mean, that's a really interesting play. You know, Microbot. It's more like trying to expand the reach of robotics into endovascular procedures. You know, in all parts of the body. And I mean, the Microbot tech is really interesting, because it's like this thing that looks like a little video game controller. And
look at the video on the website, it looks exactly like he's playing with a PlayStation, the hands of the surgeon.
It's like, yeah, my surgeon's having too much fun here. I mean, he's got a little like video game controller thing and a robotic box that's controlling this guide wire and catheter that's, you know, being, you know, run up into somebody's vasculature. I mean, pretty wild technology,
which would rule me out, by the way, because I cannot handle my son's PlayStation. It's just like there's too many buttons. It's just too much going on.
I don't have time, Tom. I need to read books. I can't be.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. NPR.
Yes.
So,
and by the way, if you donate $50 to Device Box, you can we'll send you the tote bag.
Tote bag.
Talk tote bag.
So our Device Talks mug, we definitely need to get a fundraiser going. So in addition to Moon Surgical, of course, this morning the news broke that the Karl Storz acquisition of Asensus is going forward. So that's going to happen as well. And we talked about that at length with Joe Mullins a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. So folks can look at that. I'll link to that. I'll link to that podcast in the show notes, because Joe gives a good overview of sort of what it could mean. And now we can even more definitively say what it will mean.
Exactly.
So we were all excited. I was all abuzz about Karl Storz, you know, entering the surgical robotics market. It seems like a good strategy for a company that doesn't have a system to acquire a system that's further along, rather than invest money in developing their own. But there's also some questions as to, I know you've been talking to folks, Chris, about, you know, exactly what is it Karl Storz wants with this technology? Is it the robot, or is it something else?
I think that's something we need in our own reporting to find out more, like what is it in the, you know, IP and technology that the census have that Storz is looking at. So that'll be interesting to find out.
Well, Asensus had their ISU, which is what, the intelligent surgery unit, their AI aided system. Everything seems to be AI aided these days, but we'll go along with that. Which could, I think, enhance Storz's tower, which Storz is already placing, as I think Joe said, 500 towers a year. There were numbers in that previous podcast that I was just listening to because the news just broke. So, I mean, this could be a play for Storz building up the strength of its tower and going at Stryker's leadership in that space. And something that Joe also mentioned in the podcast is just the and we've heard from others as well, the Da Vinci 5's tower. Da Vinci
Yeah.
Intuitive's DaVinci 5 tower is...
The computing power is just unbelievable.
Yeah, is amazing and could give Intuitive a move into that market as well. So this may be as much a battle over tower space than it is over surgical robotics. It's going to be interesting to see what develops.
Yeah, this will be really interesting. And you just were mentioning Stryker. And Stryker is the next story Stryker's the next story we're looking at here, which is Stryker agreed to acquire a soft tissue fixation developer, Artelon. I hope I pronounced that correctly, but they agreed to acquire them. This kind of plays into something I caught in a Stryker earnings call early this year. When Kevin Lobo was saying they were going to be going on the offensive with M&A. They've actually done a lot of M&A already. I mean, there was a note recently from Needham that we covered where they said that Stryker completed more than 50 acquisitions over the past 10 years. But it's been the deal volume has been smaller in recent years. But they were saying too, management aim indicating they're ramping up M&A, and here we go. We got another acquisition from Stryker. In this case, a company that specializes in this soft tissue fixation for foot and ankle and sports medicine procedures.
Yeah, no, I mean this certainly is an interesting acquisition, and we just spoke with Gary. I just talked with Gary Justack of Enovis's foot and ankle business last week in the podcast, so we can folks can certainly find that. And learn what a competitive space that is. I mean, it's really is the size of Enovis' portfolio, and I don't know how it compares to Stryker, was kind of surprising. I thought maybe they'd have like 10 products in there, and it just goes on and on and on, which makes sense because the foot and the ankle are so complex. Yes, going back to Stryker, your article got a lot of attention, I think generated a lot of enthusiasm in folks, because as interesting as this deal is, I think as soon as you hear Kevin Lobo talking about Stryker M&A, you're thinking of Vocera. You're obviously thinking Mako. You're thinking Wright. You're thinking something big. So this deal will scratch the itch that many of us have for a Stryker deal.
I think we're and actually this isn't in the Needham analysts listed areas where they thought they saw Stryker most likely to make deals. You want to hear the list really quick?
Yes.
Why not? Let's do it. They said peripheral vascular neuromodulation, women's health, urology, and and soft tissue robotics.
Soft tissue robotics. Well, we had Spencer Stiles on the Stryker Talks podcast a bit ago and asked him straight out if they would look into soft tissue, and I thought he would wave me off and not even address the question, but he just said, we're an M&A company. It's an interesting space. Let's see. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing. So, and I had that in my medical design and outsourcing article too. So it was not a no. Maybe it could have been a fake. Maybe they're Neuromod would be an interesting ad for them since they're already, leaders in the neurovascular space. Certainly a lot of different directions they
could go. Out of you? I didn't listen to that one. You're like, were you like,
I didn't, well, like Michael Barrow at the Daily.
Sorry, Michael.
You're fantastic. We love you, Michael.
I listen to you a lot. You're good, man.
I'm sure Michael's sweating. Jam those device talks, guys. I'm going to stop listening to that podcast. Right. So, but no, those are interesting spaces that the analyst listed out. And for me, at least, this deal doesn't scratch the M&A itch. I think Stryker, the gauntlet is thrown down, Kevin Lobo. We demand more. We want a bigger deal.
We're going to be keeping an eye on this. And, I'd say, keep an eye. We'll be keeping track of this on Mass Device. See what happens next.
I think I can kind of announce this. It's not up on a website yet, but Andy Pierce, group president of MedSurge and Neurotech at Stryker, will be a keynote at Device Talks West.
Oh, so, fantastic.
Yeah, we'll be talking to him. So hopefully he'll have a big deal to talk about at that time. We can break a big deal down with him. So, if they can get the big deal done before Device Talks West, which is October 16th and 17th. That would be best for me, if anyone Stryker cares about what's
I mean, I'm sure they're like, what can we do to help Tom out?
What can we do to help Tom out? I wish everybody thought that way.
I try, Tom. I'm
like, you do? Oh, no. You're one of the good ones, Chris Newmarker. You're one of the good ones. You're on
buddy.
Team Tom for sure. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
All right. What's our final newsmaker?
You've got to be serious, Tom.
NPR voice. Yes. NPR. Chris, what is our next item on the Newmarker's Newsmakers?
Well, Tom. So the next, our final item here, like getting a lot of attention on Mass Device, is a BD. Saying they're going to acquire Edwards Life Sciences critical care business for $4.2 billion. So there we go. There's a big M&A deal. It's just not Stryker, but it's, BD buying the Edwards critical care business, which they'd previously been talking about spinning out. But
yeah, no, that was that I had put on LinkedIn this week. Like, I this makes so much sense. I should have been spreading rumors that it was going to happen weeks ago, because it's just so it's just so intuitive and just makes so much sense. I think it's great news for both companies. I think Edwards Life Sciences, which is really tripling down now on structural heart, will have a lot of money to invest in innovation and acquisition and really build out those businesses rather than kind of wait it out with a spin out. And critical care has access to all that BD is doing in that space. And BD obviously has probably the biggest footprint in healthcare in terms of all the products it touches. So they'll be able to plug into that. My one minor disappointment was I was hoping we'd have another medtech woman medtech CEO, Katie Simons, who's going to be CEO of critical care. But she'll be leading the group at BD. And BD's got a lot of great leaders who are women. Including Beth McCombs, who we had as a keynote at Device Talks Boston. So,
yeah, that was a really good talk.
So, so I think it's great news all around, for sure.
Very much. And the analysts were, saying the same thing, that they, they were positive about this deal, even Truist analysts were saying they thought the sale provides a cleaner transaction, for Edwards than that those previously announced plans to do.
And we've seen other spinouts.
It's interesting. We've had these kind of public company deals. We've purported, that are getting some visibility on Mass Device. But one thing, it was interesting. I reached out to, the people we know, John Norris and others at HSBC, it was just an email. It was what's going on right now with the M&A front? And it was kind of the quick thing I got back from John was that, we're not, it's been kind of, slim pickings on venture-backed M&A this year, which is, kind of, there were previous thoughts that, we saw some pretty big, exits, at the end of last year that might have, whetted more appetites for that kind of stuff in the space. We had, Boston Scientific acquiring, Relievant Med Systems for $850 million. We had, Inari Medical acquiring LimFlow for $415 million. We had J&J MedTech, acquiring a Laminar for $400 million. But, it's been just not a lot of that, so far this year. And, and I know at Device Talks Boston, talking to a lot of people in the fundraising community, the overall sense I got was that, it's still kind of a tough environment to raise money right now. So, but hey, on the flip side, good employment report today. Fingers crossed that doesn't, keep the Fed from hopefully lowering rates later this year, which could get things moving again.
I think lower interest rates, if borrowing were necessary, would certainly be an important aspect. But I don't know. We'll see how the year plays out. I remember trying to do these horse race articles about, Q2 is less than Q2 of last year. What's that mean? Yeah. And people were like, it means that there were fewer deals this year than there were last year. But let's just wait and see how things play out. So,
totally. The season, there isn't that kind of seasonality that you see on other industries. I mean, so it's not necessarily
predictive. So we'll see where it goes. But no, that's, I mean, yeah. Going back to our item, I think it's great. I think BD is really, for a company, I think, that had a perception of being somewhat, quote unquote, sleepy. I don't know. They're coming out with a lot of cool tech. They're really building a large presence. You know, going back to surgical robotics, they're not a player in that space yet, but they're a sponsor down at SRS. I see that, which was kind of interesting. And I know mm-hmm. they've invested in companies like Vicarious, so they're certainly nibbling around the edges in that. So they'll be an interesting company to watch. And I think this union yeah. is a good one for MedTech. So so that's great news.
Yeah. Yeah, very good news. So well, that's a wrap. Well, so mostly positive new markers newsmakers
yes,
today.
Yes, no, we'll slip in the negative when it's there. But I guess some invitation to our listeners, yeah. if you have some thoughts on how you like this segment to sort of shape, I think we'll probably stick with talking deeply about three items. And maybe we'll do something on LinkedIn and try to get people more involved and try to get thoughts from others as well, and maybe get some listeners on here to express their thoughts either through something we read or something they record. So we could have a lot of fun with it. But it's good to be back, Chris.
Yeah. Send us your feedback. You know, does the three stories, you know, work well? Do you like our NPR
yes,
voices?
No, that's a good question.
I mean, you know, like we're open
do
to
you really
that,
need yeah. another tote Indeed. Bag? I'd like yeah, to so know yeah. that, because like how many tote yeah. bags is one? How much toting do you do, Chris? Do you tote a lot? We have kids. You have little kids, so you probably tote a great deal.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, I need something big enough to get some soccer balls or water bottles in. So, you know, I don't.
Yeah, one tote bag, you can't even get a soccer ball like, in there unless it's like one of those little kid soccer balls.
Here, kids, share the water bottle. Like, you know, it's not gonna. I've got a little thing of bug spray. You know, here. Let's. This is, yeah, we don't. Yeah, we need something more substantial. Like, Dad needs a chair in there. I need a fold-out chair.
We'll get the research department on it.
Something space age, yeah.
All right, Chris Neumarker. Great job.
Great as always, man.
All right, it was great to have Chris Neumarker and his new markers, newsmakers, back on the podcast. He'll be back next week with more of the news that you might need to know and lots of stuff that you could probably do without. But hey, that's you listened, so it's on you. Our next conversation is, again, with the chairman and CEO of Profound Medical. I got a great opportunity to speak with Arun Menawat. Once again, Arun Menawat, and we'll go through his background in the interview, but he had previously been chairman and CEO of Novadaq, which was acquired by Stryker. Before that, he was president of Sidera Software, which played a big role in lots of MR devices and systems. So I got a great education on the sort of the history of imaging and how it's becoming a more essential part of therapy. So let's hear from Arun Menawat, again, chairman and CEO of Profound Medical. If you want more information about Profound Medical, go to profoundmedical.com. Well, Arun Menawat, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
Excited to hear Profound Medical's story, but as always, we love to start off with story about our guests and how they found their way into the medical device industry. What was the route that took you into MedTech?
Tom, you know, I grew up in the Northeast, and my dad was a medical doctor, and my interest was more on engineering side. So I decided to help develop new types of diagnosis and new types of treatments rather than treat.
Okay.
And so I went to University of Maryland and National Institutes of Health. So I learned all of my clinical work in NIH, and I did PhD in biomedical engineering from University of Maryland.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, imaging became really important to me early on because I felt that I should try to come up with customized ways to treat patients and make their disease as individualized as possible. And that was really, you know, to be able to see inside the patient without any, you know, incision and so on was, you know, from the very beginning, that was my interest.
Imaging isn't typically an area that, I mean, obviously people are drawn to imaging, but I talk more with people who are developing stents or valves or things that are physical, but you're right about imaging. I mean, it's a critical part of the whole therapeutic process.
Yes.
Was there a moment that you came upon some imaging technology that really kind of woke you up and caught your attention?
You're right. It's not talked about much, but imaging, you know, in the 70s used to be about x-ray. Mm-hmm. And they always wanted to see broken bones. But by the 80s, imaging was about soft tissue. You know, MRI came on scene, and you could now visualize inside. And the whole idea that you could see cancer at its early stages. And then, you know, PET imaging came about, and x-ray turned into CT imaging. So there was this big revolution of imaging from the mid-80s all the way to about 2005, where we went from perhaps doing x-ray imaging to today, there are about 600 million images done per year in the United States. So for wow. every one person living, there are two images done per year. So it is an incredible revolution. It's just been a very silent revolution. And my personal view has always been, and I was lucky enough to be part of that revolution. And my personal view was that if it's important to diagnose a patient using imaging, and today, mm-hmm. you know, most serious diseases are diagnosed with imaging, my message was, you know, why would you not give imaging to the surgeon who's actually treating the patient? So sure. you actually have better treatment also. And so that's what, if you look at the common link among all the companies that I've helped build, that's the common link, is diagnosing using imaging, saving these images properly, interpreting these images, mm-hmm. and then providing tools to surgeons to do better surgery using imaging.
So what was your first work in the imaging space?
So the first one was really about diagnostic imaging. And mm-hmm. this is when, as I mentioned, MRI, CT, all these imaging modalities were commercializing. And the company that I was president of, the company called Sidera Software, and we supplied the imaging to all the major medical diagnostic imaging companies like GE, Philips, Siemens, Hitachi, and so on. And we were the largest software supplier to these companies. You know, when they went to the hospital, the name showed up as GE or Philips, but inside, the software was written by our team. At one point, half of the MRI sold in the world were written by our company.
Wow.
And yeah, so we were based in Toronto. So it was a big, it was a big thing, and we, you know, learned a lot, and we helped grow that whole industry.
So are you a president and COO of Sidera, which was spelled C-E-D-A-R-A, software, until 2003, and then you joined Novadaq Technologies. I don't know what the role was when you right. joined, but ultimately became chairman, CEO, and president. How did that move come about?
You know, once Sidera became profitable, the board basically said it would be a good idea for you to do a startup in imaging, and the Novadaq was just new technology, so I joined as CEO of Novadaq right away, and it was a very much a startup, 5-6 people in the company, and it was the next leg from the conversation we're having, in the sense that Novadaq was about providing fluorescence imaging to surgeons who could improve the quality of surgery that they're doing. So they could, in real world, see blood vessels. They could see blood flow. Mm-hmm. They could differentiate between normal tissue and abnormal tissue. And thereby, the outcomes of the surgeries that they performed would, you know, theoretically would be better. And that concept, you know, took a while, but again, became very popular. And today, you know, most major endoscope companies provide a fluorescence imaging platform. In fact, our number one customer early on was Intuitive Surgical, where we licensed the technology to them. And so the vision systems that they produced used the fluorescence imaging that we produced.
How was it received from surgeons? Was there a similar resistance to other technology where surgeons feel like they're, you know, it's fine just the way it is, we don't need this fancy technology, or was it, oh my God, I can actually see more clearly now, and this is such a great benefit? How was it received by the community?
I think you're right. The surgery community in general is conservative.
Yeah.
So they want to see, you know, quite a bit of data before they're going to use it on a patient, which quite frankly makes sense. But in our case, they could clearly see things. And so it was a combination of, hey, oh my God, now I can see all this. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Now I can do things with more confidence. But at the same time, they always also came back to, okay, I can see all this and so on, but I still need clinical data to be able to show that I can actually improve outcomes. So I think to some extent, the fact that it was imaging helped us get the doors opened, but then we did do quite a bit of clinical work to show them the value of the technology. And the place where we really started to resonate was in reconstructive surgeries. Because reconstruction, when people have accidents or breast cancers and breasts are reconstructed, they can see everything is on the outside of the body. So when there's the skin goes dead or something happens, they can clearly see it. And I think when we were able to show it to them during the surgery, or what, where to cut and where not to, they could easily then see that, hey, if they followed the images, they could actually improve outcomes very quickly. So it took a while, no doubt, and it always does. But once they got it, I think it was relatively quick.
What was the, it was a fluorescence imaging technology, but what was the basis for your R&D? When you're developing new imaging tools, is it a chemical process? What's the engineering that goes into developing new products?
Yeah, so it was a combination. So we did inject a fluorescent molecule, a generic molecule, which is very safe. Molecule has been around for 40 plus years, has been used for many years. The trick, however, was in the hardware that we developed. And the trick was that, you know, when you get a light bulb and you see that the light bulb where is directly underneath is brighter than what's on the sides. The trick was for us to normalize. So you would see the same amount of intensity, and thereby the fluorescence that you get from the images reflects the amount of chemical in the blood, not the reflection of the light.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the key to the success, because then once you have fully diffused, normalized images, you could see where there's less blood and where there's more blood, right? And that is how we were able to differentiate between good tissue and not so good tissue.
What is the regulatory path like for technology like this, and how does reimbursement sort of come into play? I mean, do you get a special code for that, or do you have to just find a way to fit under the general cost of a procedure that's being done?
Yeah, so we you know, at the end of the day, it was a safe molecule and it was a device. Mm-hmm. So we worked with, it was the first time anybody had done anything like this. So
really?
We actually went to the FDA and we said, we're not here to file anything or do anything. We're here to really help you understand our technology. And they gave us the time to meet with us, and they loved the whole thing. And they then helped us determine a pretty comfortable pathway. So we did do clinical work, but at the same time, it was a standard device-based clearance for us.
Interesting.
Now, to your second question, the reimbursement was a very different story, because at the end of the day, the value proposition for our company was about improving clinical outcomes and thereby reducing the cost of surgery. You know, if you can improve the outcome, patients don't have to stay longer, there are fewer complications, they don't have to come back for a second surgery and so on. So the message from CMS was, hey, if you guys are really going to do this, which they were very strongly supportive of, their message was you need to be part of standard DRG, which is inpatient surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fair. You know, it took the hospital some time to realize that indeed it would save them money. And there were many hospitals where we would go in, we would say, let's do 20 cases and we can show you against your normal complications how many you have. And I think that method worked because they could clearly see that they could actually improve their profitability.
Were those freebies?
Yeah, it was. That was certainly one of those. The other part was patients, you know, wanted the product. Sure. So women who were getting breast reconstructions could clearly see that, hey, this would really help them. That's so great. Many of the patients, you know, asked for it, and many of the breast cancer societies, you know, supported our technology.
That's great. So you led Novadaq Technologies to an IPO, right? And then ultimately to acquisition by Stryker.
To an acquisition by Stryker. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Why did that acquisition make sense? I mean, it was a handsome payment. It was a $701 million. Yeah. So that certainly makes a lot of sense. But what did that mean for you, for that your technology that you started from scratch and kind of got it incorporated into the healthcare regimen, and now it's part of a large med tech? What is that feeling like?
You know, to be honest, it feels great.
Yeah.
Because we took the company to where we could as a small company. And, you know, Stryker acquired the company. They have done great with it. They have been very positive about the acquisition. They have grown that business. And not only that, they have grown the business, as I said, other companies that are big in the same space have all copied or tried to copy those technologies. So fluorescence imaging is very much a standard now. Mm-hmm. And it's become a multi-billion dollar business. So I think as an entrepreneur, you know, you look for a number of things. You look for your employee satisfaction, and then the team did very well. You look for shareholders satisfaction. Most of my shareholders did very well. And you look to have your technology be used by, you know, physicians and patients in our case. And that is all true. So I think from a multiple perspective, it was a very satisfying experience. And the one before that, Siddhara, as well, too, that today imaging is a very big business and we had a good part in doing it. So, from that perspective, it's been, you know, very good.
That's excellent. So let's talk about the company that you're leading today, Profound Medical. How did you find your way to the company? Were you involved in the start, or did you come in to join it?
So first of all, I think to the thread, I call this the third leg. Mm-hmm. Because the first one was about diagnosing the patient. The second one was improving the quality of surgery with imaging. But the third leg is to really come up with a new way to treat a patient where imaging is an integral part of the treatment. And that is what Profound is. And so I, you know, received calls early on while I was still CEO of Novadaq that this technology was looking very interesting. And then in 2014, they asked me if I could join the board of the company, which I did. And then by 2016, when some of the early work had already been done and I was exiting from Novadaq, it just made sense, logical sense, to then take on as the CEO of the company as well. So I did that in 2016.
So you know, very, very little time in between, it seems, between Novadaq and Profound.
I have really enjoyed what I do. I think the time between Novadaq and Profound was 4 weeks. So that's plenty of time. That's all you need.
So yes. Tell us a bit about Profound and what it's able to do, or what the company, you have couple of technologies. What is your overall mission?
Yeah. So overall mission, Tom, is actually really important. If you look at surgery, there is a trend. You go back 40 years, you see surgery was typically done what is called open surgery. You know, you cut the patient several inches and you go inside and you cut out the bad part and you sew the patient back up. That then changed from open surgeries to what they call minimally invasive surgeries, where you drilled holes into the patient and then you could go in and do the surgery with smaller holes. The whole idea being that instead of having to stay in the hospital for 5-10 days and recovery would be months, you could recover faster, could reduce the hospital stay, and more importantly, recovery and complications could be improved upon. Now, with this, we are taking it to the next mm-hmm. step, which is completely incision free, meaning no incision. You can image the patient in real life, real time. You could identify the abnormal zone of the patient. Like in our case, it's prostate cancer. You could identify the zone, and you could then send sound waves to gently heat the tissue to kill temperature, and thereby the tissue is dead. And patient simply wake up after the procedure is done. There's no incision. They go home the same day. No hospital stay, no blood loss, virtually no pain. Most patients will go to work within a couple of days after this. Right? So it's a game-changing idea, and imaging is an integral part of this technology. Mm-hmm. Right? And when I talk about incision-free and no blood loss, you know, it sounds interesting, but it's more than interesting in the sense that, you know, patients who get prostate cancer in particular, they're elderly. And more often than not, they will have comorbidities. They might be on a blood thinner. They might have heart disease. They might have other diabetes and so on. And so going to this idea of incision-free and when there's no blood loss, all those patients can be treated with amazing safety, right? So this is a very big deal. This is not just a product. This is a whole new concept of going from incision. When we think about surgery, we think about incision and recovery time and pain. Whereas here, patient goes in, they go into the MR, they're sleeping for a couple of hours. Surgeon actually sees in real time exactly where the disease is. They see the organ, they see the prostate, they define the zone that they want to kill. The robotic arm that just does it automatically. They sit and watch the screen. The patient comes out and
goes let's zoom out a bit just on the state of prostate disease. And I want to get a better understanding for myself where your procedure, your TULSA-PRO procedure fits in. Talk a bit broadly about how serious a disease that we're talking about, prostate disease.
I'll share the very high level for a second. You know, as men get older, and worldwide men are getting older, there are, in fact, two things that worry about the most these days as compared to 20, 30 years ago. 20, 30 years ago, people who would get into their 50s and 60s would have heart disease and so on. Today, they worry about two organs. They worry about their brain health. Mm-hmm. They don't want to lose memory. Second thing they worry about, they want to have an active life, so they worry about their prostate. Mm-hmm. They want to be sexually active. They want to be able to go and not have to go to the washroom all the time. Mm-hmm. And so those two things they worry about, they think about more. And so prostate cancer, in fact, is 1 in 8 men have prostate cancer.
Wow.
So it's one of the largest diseases. After skin cancer, is the second highest cancer prevalence of cancer. Right. So it's a major disease. In addition to that, many of the patients don't necessarily have cancer, but their prostates, for reasons we don't know, prostates just grow in size, so they have difficulty urinating. And so that's what we're looking to address.
Okay.
Is they can have active life, big market. They can have reduced the size of the prostate if that's what's causing urination. If they have cancer, we can take care of the cancer. And we have enough data to show durability that, quite frankly, I think, you know, once you've done this, you're set for life. And I think that is a big proposition.
So you're able to both treat the benign prostate disease that is non-cancerous and the kind of thing that people just kind of sit and wait to see what happens, as well as the cancer. So is this an alternative to prostatectomy? You mentioned Intuitive earlier. I mean, this is obviously their primary entry point. Do you see this as an alternative and as a ultimately maybe replacement for all those procedures, or are you only able to treat a subset of patients, do you think?
So we have shown through clinical data that we can treat a wide variety of patients.
Wow.
In fact, we can treat a wider variety of patients than the robotic system can. So I think that part we've addressed. But yes, I do think that just like, you know, open surgery was replaced with minimally invasive surgery, which was then replaced with robotic surgery, I think we're the next in that line where we're now taking it to incision-free surgery with real-time imaging and be able to treat wide variety. So yeah, I do think that we will be replacing some of the current treatments. You know, the clinical data shows at least 20% of the patients become incontinent today after those surgeries. More than 20%, maybe closer to 40%, end up losing their erectile function, versus our data is far superior to those outcomes. So just on that alone, we think we have a significant leg up. But on the other parts where patients care about being able to go home and no incision and all that, and being able to treat patients with comorbidity, all that adds to the value proposition for
us. Who is performing these procedures? What specialist? Urologist?
So typically it's the urologist, yeah. And I think it's an important question, actually, because, you know, historically, imaging has been the domain of the radiologist. And when we started, that was one of the questions people asked. You know, radiologists were saying, well, I'm a radiologist. I know how to read these images. So should I be able to do this procedure? And some interventional radiologists are doing the procedure. But the reality is that urologists understand the disease. They know what is cancer and how to treat the patient. And so for us, it was a lot easier to say to the urologist, you need to be able to read these images. And the big aha for them was the paradigm. The original paradigm was, well, I don't know how to read the MR image. And the answer to that was, you know, we're not asking you to diagnose the disease. The radiologist will still diagnose the disease like they always have. What we're asking you to do is determine where the cancer margins are or where the prostate margins are. And that is very easy to do. That is something they do even today, because they look at MR images even today to make the determination of what to do with the patient, what's the right course of action for treating the patient. And so once they understood that, hey, we're not asking you to do something that is the radiology's domain, we're actually asking you to do it what you do already, but do it in real time, they got it. And I think now, even for residencies, you know, American Urological Society is saying urologists need to be able to read MRIs. So that change is now in the process of happening. And I think it's just like any other technology. You have, it takes some time for people to see that, hey, this is not as hard as I thought. And the clinical data is pretty strong.
So I want to understand the clinical trials that you've run. But first, I just kind of want to get an image in my head as to what this procedure looks like. I'm picturing a big table with a big thing aiming at somebody. What does your device look like, and how is the treatment applied, and what is the setting? Is it in a ambulatory surgery center? Is it in a doctor's office? Is it in an OR?
It can be done anywhere where there is an MR, and because there's no incision, you know, you don't have to worry about emergency procedures and things like that.
No sterile field or anything like that. There's no.
No sterile field or anything. Like, obviously, you want everything clean, but nothing in terms of necessary sterile field. The doctors, they don't put scrubs on. They don't do anything. Yep. They go and sit at the computer screen. Right. So everywhere there's an MR, there are about 30,000 MRs in the U.S. So we can do it at an imaging center. A lot of them are by shopping centers. We can do it at ASCs who have MRs or want to get an MR. We certainly do it in hospitals where they have multiple MRs. So we're pretty flexible in that sense. The procedure itself is actually, in terms of modification of the system, we have relationship with all of the major MR companies. So effectively, we have a hardwire that connects to the MR that allows us to take images. The patient sleeps on the same MR bed that they sleep today for diagnostic purposes, but we put a very small robotic arm in between the legs, and there is a disposable catheter that goes in to the center of the prostate. Mm-hmm. Right. So in terms of, you know, modification to the MR, it's minimal. The new thing is that they do need anesthesia in the MR to keep the patient asleep. That takes some time to put in. But outside of that, the rest of this is all done on a computer.
Similar anesthesia to a colonoscopy, a lighter anesthesia, or do they need the heavy anesthesia? Is it?
It's typically, you know, typically you want full anesthesia to make sure there's no movement. Yep.
Okay, yeah. Interesting.
So that's what we recommend.
So talk a bit about the trials. You've got some interesting data, some encouraging data. Talk about the trials that this has been run through.
Absolutely. So the first trial that we run was called the TAC trial. The primary purpose of that trial was to get FDA clearance. Mm-hmm. And we did 115 patients, large trial, and we treated whole gland, meaning FDA wanted to see our clinical outcomes against, you know, it was not necessarily part of the trial itself, but they wanted to see how does it compare to prostatectomy. So they said, you got to do what prostatectomy does, which is whole gland mm-hmm. treatment. And that is what we did. And the clinical data showed virtually no incontinence. I think one patient had some incontinence. And then no severe erectile dysfunction. There are about 17% patients who had minor erectile dysfunction that is treatable with drugs for them. But really, the clinical outcomes were significantly superior to any of these today's surgeries. That was our pivotal trial. Since that time, we've had 40, 50 publications. Just this year, there were over 25 presentations on TULSA technology. So pretty heavily studied. And we've had multiple centers that are showing significantly. In fact, they're showing not just better side effects in terms of these incontinence and erectile dysfunction, but they're also showing significantly better ability to manage the cancer, and the outcomes of these real-world patients are actually significantly better than those of prostatectomy. Hmm. So we feel pretty good about the clinical data. And in fact, we feel so good that we're the only company that has now sponsored a full comparative study where we're comparing our treatment to radical prostatectomy. Wow. And this is fully randomized. It qualifies as what they call level one evidence mm-hmm. study. And once you get that level one evidence, then there's no, you know, societies will use that to make recommendations. Insurance companies will use it to reimburse. Patients and doctors will feel like, hey, there's solid evidence that they can opt for our technology without worrying about any liability whatsoever. So I think we have done, you know, we're very strong on technology and clinical value creation. We have substantial body of evidence already, but this trial will start reading out early next mm-hmm. year. We're recruiting at a pretty rapid pace. It's about a 201 patient trial. We're, you know, pretty much about 75% recruited already.
How is the radical prostatectomy being performed? Is it with a robot or is it a standard way?
Yeah, primarily it's a U.S. study, and most every patient is going to be a robotic patient.
So we're...
But technically it's still radical prostatectomy.
It's still radical, yeah. where are you, and you may have stated this, but I just want to be clear, with regulatory approval, and you mentioned insurers before, I don't know if you have any sort of reimbursement code yet or CPT code yet. Where are you with that?
So, Tom, we received regulatory clearance in August of 2019, and we started marketing in the...
From the FDA?
From the FDA, yes. And we started marketing in January of 2020, mm-hmm. and COVID started in March of 2020,
sure.
which was interesting to be bringing something so different and new, not be able to travel to our sites. But, you know, we are over 50 sites in the U.S. already. Majority of these sites are teaching opinion leading hospitals. And we focused on them on purpose because that is how you drive, you know, standard adoption, because new patients and many of the physicians look towards these opinion leading sites. And we have very good reviews from these guys. Many of these teaching sites have presented in conferences already and confirmed that their data is similar to our pivotal trial data also. Mm-hmm. And so with all of that and the clinical data, you know, we were getting very strong support from the societies that support prostate disease, cancers, and so on. And so in 2023, last year, our application for new, entirely new reimbursement codes was sponsored by six different societies.
Wow.
And it was very, very quickly, as you can imagine, approved. Virtually no questions. It just went through the American Medical Association meeting very, very quickly. It's among the fastest technology of this caliber to get full CPT Category 1 code. So the codes have been approved. The standard process, once they're approved, is it takes about 15 to 18 months to get them implemented. So in July this year, CMS will publish what the payment amount would be against these codes, and that will become effective January 2025. So effectively, what we've accomplished so far is we have regulatory clearance, we have majority of leading hospitals already using our product, we have reimbursement codes approved. We'll know in about 8 weeks what the payment is, and then those codes will become effective by January 2025. So in the meantime, you know, majority of our patient population is cash pay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, typical patient pays about $35,000. And we are treating, you know, just about 1,000 patient run rate at the moment.
Interesting. So that's, I mean, it says something that there's that many patients who are willing to pay
yes.
themselves. So, and we spoke earlier about sort of how healthcare, how surgeons are traditionally conservative. It sounds as if from what you're saying that you're not running up against that sort of counterforce here.
Yeah. I mean, in our market entry strategy, we were very, very focused. So one of the things we did is we explicitly focused on those who are typically considered early adopters. Mm-hmm. And that concept worked for us. The second thing we did was we didn't go to a hospital and say, hey, here's this great technology, start using it. We went to the hospitals and we said, here's our clinical data. Here's the technology. You can see, because we do imaging, you can see it works. And we said, you know, assign one of your urologists to start using it and get your own experience. And majority of them said, you know, we're going to do 30 patients, we're going to do 50 patients, and then we're going to measure the outcomes on our own, and we're going to understand if it is indeed as good as you say it is. And we said, yeah, we have the patience to do it the right way. And quite frankly, every one of them came back and said they can show that their data is at least as good as the clinical trial data, and they could see the patient satisfaction from this. So sure. I think you're right. We didn't go there and say, let's just go. And in the meantime, by the way, we kept collecting data. And there were a number of surgeons who said, listen, I'm not an early adopter. When you get 5 to 10 year data, then you call me. And that's fine. We will do that.
So let's start looking ahead a bit. How is AI sort of fitting into all this? Seems to be the question that I have to ask everybody now, how AI is changing your approach. But this would seem to be an area where with imaging and AI, it would be a perfect fit for some sort of assistance.
Absolutely. And Tom, our AI programs are over 3 years old. So at the time when AI was kind of an untouchable word, we were doing it, but we were not telling anyone. So we actually got our second AI module approved or cleared by the FDA a few weeks ago, just a couple of weeks ago. And you know, it is very real AI, but it's also very real value. So as I mentioned to you, you know, our images come from the MR and the surgeons see the live image. And so what they do today is they have to tell the computer, they have to tell our system what the margins are, what are the margins that they should kill. It'll be the margin of the prostate, it could be the margin less than the prostate, and so on. That is manually done on the screen. And that typically takes about 45 minutes to an hour to do today. Mm-hmm. So our AI module, is we call it contouring assistant. It basically then, you get to the image and they press a button and it now provides a recommended treatment design. So this recommended treatment design is based upon prior successful treatments. So it gives the urologists two things. One, it gives them tremendous confidence that, hey, this treatment is based upon successful patients, so I can rely on it a little bit, but also saves them tremendous amount of time. They can look at it, they can say, yep, I like this, and they can move to the next. Or they can say, hey, I like 80% of it, and a pen shows up, and they can just very quickly mark whatever they want to change to this, and they can then move to the next. So it's not only going to, we think, going to give them confidence and maybe improve outcomes, but more certainly it will save them significant amount of time. And, you know, these days, as you know, there are more and more patients and less physicians. So being able to do it more efficiently and quickly, it means a lot to everybody.
Great. And final question, I mean, just looking ahead, what does this mean for surgery and where could this technology, where could Profound be applied outside of the prostate? Are there other applications?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, you know, this is not just a product. This is a whole new idea of being able to treat patients without incision using real-time MRI. So we do have pipeline of technologies, and we're already treating patients in Europe and Asia where women who have uterine pain due to fibroids or adenomyosis. These patients are being treated today. And so we think that technology at some point we will bring to the United States also. We think over the long term, solid organ tumors could be another target for us. Mm-hmm. So I think that this thing, hopefully as we go from prostate to other types of pain management to other types of cancers. So I do see this as broadening significantly over the next, you know, 2 to 5 years.
Profound is a fascinating story, and I think an optimistic one and a hopeful one for folks who want to avoid surgery of any kind in the future, radical or otherwise. Thank you so much, Arun, for joining us on the podcast and for sharing Profound's story.
Thank you so much, Tom. Definitely we will continue this and we'll keep you updated.
Excellent. All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Thanks again to Profound Medical for sponsoring. If you'd like to find out more about Profound Medical, go to profoundmedical.com. If you'd like to find out or receive more episodes of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast, if you want to go hunt them out, you can find them at devicetalks.com. But I'm willing to send them directly to you. And all you need to do is subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network on any major podcast player. You'll not only get Device Talks Weekly, but Stryker Talks, Intuitive Talks, Device Talks AI, lots of our other great podcasts, all bringing you great knowledge about the medical device industry. So it's free. Just go to any major podcast player and push subscribe or follow or whatever they're calling it. They all work the same, and they'll all get they'll all send future episodes sent directly to your phone or computer or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Once again, don't forget Device Talks Tuesdays is rolling. Go to devicetalks.com to register for our next discussion brought to you by Tekin, and look for our future episodes as well. We're booked for the year. Lots going on, lots to learn, so make sure you don't miss them. Finally, connect with me on LinkedIn. Why not? I love connecting with folks on LinkedIn. I love following your stories. I love following your feeds. And I reach out a lot. And it's always neat when someone says, oh, I love the podcast. Thanks for connecting. I certainly believe them when they say that, but I would like to say, well, I wish you'd connected with me. If you like the podcast, just reach out, follow. I'd prefer a connection, but would love to again. I learned from our listeners and I learned from our folks on LinkedIn. So it'd be wonderful to follow your stories. So connect with me, connect with Kayleen Brown, our managing editor, and of course with Mr. Newsmaker himself, Chris Newmarker, the editor-in-chief of Mass Device. All right. Thanks, folks. Tune in next week. We've got another great episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast coming your way.